Good evening.
Governor Cuomo begs Washington to help as coronavirus cases skyrocket. Advocates say it's time to release elderly prisoners, and a conflict between police and purveyors of free food in a Newark housing project. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with some of the news for Monday, March 30th, 2020. Governor Andrew Cuomo issued an urgent appeal for medical volunteers Monday amid a staggering number of deaths from the coronavirus. He warned the crisis unfolding in New York City is just a preview of what other communities across the U.S. could soon face. "We've lost over 1,000 New Yorkers," Cuomo said to me. "We're beyond staggering already. We've reached staggering." Cuomo added that the apex, the peak number of cases, seems to be approaching in New York as the geometric rise might be easing, even as the absolute numbers are still skyrocketing.
Rate has slowed. We had a doubling of cases every 2 days, then a doubling every 3 days, then a doubling every 4 days, then every five. We now have a doubling of cases every 6 days. So while the overall number is going up, the rate of doubling is actually down. The daily intubation rate is way up. Again, sometimes it's just an anomaly. There's no clear pattern, as you can see from those past several nights. Discharge rate, again, that by and large is going up. People come into the hospital, they stay for a period of time, number of days, and then they move on. There are only two operations that we need to perform. First, the public has to be responsible. Stay at home. When I issued the stay-at-home order, it wasn't, "It would be nice if you did." It is a mandate. Stay at home. If you're a non-essential worker, stay at home. If you leave the house, you're exposing yourself to danger. If you leave the house, you're exposing others to danger. You can get infected, go home and infect whoever is at home. So stay at home. I know the isolation can be boring and oppressive. It is better than the alternative. Still, in New York City, you have too many places with too much density. I mean, I don't know how many different ways to make the same point. New York City parks, we made the point, there's too much density. You want to go to the park, go to the park, but not in a dense area, not in playgrounds where you're playing basketball with other people. And I have said that New York City is trying to reduce the density in those playgrounds. Thus far, they have not been successful. If that continues, we'll take a mandatory action to close down playgrounds, as harsh as that sounds, but it can actually save people's lives. So that's mission one.
That directly in terms of what he was implying.
Yeah, the question is that the president suggested that PPE equipment maybe going out the back door. First, there is a warehouse in Edison, New Jersey. It's the New York City warehouse. We're creating a stockpile for someone to say, "Well, the warehouse has equipment in it. You should be using that equipment today." That defies the basic concept of planning and the basic operation that we have to have working, not just in this state, but across the country. If you are not preparing for the apex and for the high point, you are missing the entire point of the operation. So the whole stockpile concept is to prepare for the future. In terms of a suggestion that the PPE equipment is not going to a correct place, I don't know what that means. I don't know what he's trying to say. If he wants to make an accusation, then let him make an accusation. But I don't know what he's trying to say by inference.
In Europe, meanwhile, hard-hit Italy and Spain saw their death tolls climb by more than 800 each, but the World Health Organization says the numbers were potentially stabilizing, while warning this is no time to let up on tough containment measures. As of Sunday, the WHO reports nearly 635,000 confirmed COVID-19 cases and 29,891 deaths. Those numbers represent a doubling in cases of illnesses and death in less than a week. New hotspots are popping up throughout the world. Russia's cases have increased by 50% since Friday. Iran reported 42,000 confirmed cases, and Iranian President Hassan Rouhani has called for relief from U.S. sanctions and requested a $5 billion loan from the International Monetary Fund. In India, after months of inaction, leader Narendra Modi announced emergency measures on March 24th. People were suddenly restricted to their homes with no time to prepare, reported. One state minister issued shoot-on-site orders for anyone violating isolation. And the United States now has the most reported COVID-19 cases of any country, with 122,653 and 2,112 deaths nationwide as of March 29th, followed by Spain and Italy. On Sunday, President Trump announced that the national guidelines regarding social distancing measures would remain in effect until the end of April. The decision came as Trump's original 15-day plan expired, with cases still growing. Reportedly, General Motors is in the process of transitioning production lines to manufacture ventilators. Meanwhile, in the civilian market, states have reported barriers to obtaining necessary supplies, including bidding against each other and losing contracts to the federal government. Although Trump backed off from his assertion Saturday that he would ban travel from New York, several governors have issued their own travel restrictions. Texas Governor Greg Abbott expanded previously issued travel restrictions, originally for the New York tri-state area, to include mandatory quarantine for all travelers from New Orleans and several other states. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis issued several executive orders requiring all travelers arriving from New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and Louisiana to isolate or quarantine themselves for 14 days after entering Florida. Florida has said the state will not cover the cost of the required quarantines. In New York, one fragile group are elderly people in state prisons. Even as the overall prison population has declined by nearly 20%, the number of prisoners aged 50 or older rose by 46% to more than 10,000. As of March 30th, the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision has officially confirmed that 14 incarcerated people and 79 staff members in 10 prisons across New York State have tested positive for COVID-19. Today, family members of New Yorkers in state prison held a virtual press conference to announce their COVID-19 community demands for people in New York State prisons. The Release Aging People in Prison, or RAP, campaign calls on Governor Cuomo to use his executive clemency power to immediately release older people and others in prison.
We've heard from multiple credible sources that an incarcerated man at Sing Sing Correctional Facility who is exhibiting serious COVID-19 symptoms has died. According to those who shared the details with advocates, the person was 58 years old and placed in isolation after showing severe symptoms of coronavirus. He died from suffocation and did not have a respirator. This is not officially confirmed by the department, but we are waiting for the department to confirm this potential tragedy. And in the meantime, we are furious and terrified, not even knowing whether this is confirmed, that it is just a matter of time before somebody dies or more people die. First up, I'm going to call Michelle Lind, who's a RAP member in New Paltz, New York, and a family member of a currently incarcerated older person.
My husband's name is Robert Lynn. He's incarcerated at Sullivan Correctional Facility in Fallsburg, New York. He is 73 years old. He has 37 years in. He has been diagnosed with prostate cancer and underwent aggressive chemo for the entire month of February every day. My husband's not feeling well. Recently, as 2 days ago, a female officer has tested positive. Yes, she worked on his block. Am I in fear for my life? Yes. I'm begging Andrew Cuomo, please. My husband was given a ridiculous sentence for nothing. My husband didn't murder or kidnap, rape, molest anyone, and they gave him 52 life. My husband has maybe 5 good years left to come out here. I'm here alone in my home. I was self-isolated. This is day 20. I see no one. I am in contact with no one. I am alone. Robert needs to be here so we could sit and go through this together. Don't let my husband die.
Next up, we're going to have Teresa Grady, who is a RAT member from Harlem in New York City and a family member of someone currently incarcerated in New York State. Teresa.
He's incarcerated for attempted murder and a second degree assault. He's looking at 40 years. He's now entering his 15th year in Green Haven. Our family members that are elderly in these prisons, there's no separation for them. You know, my husband's thing is that he's scared to go to the medical because he don't want to be around the people who are supposed to serve their medicines, but are not wearing gloves, not wearing masks. The food, as far as the mess hall, he's like, I'm not going down here. I'm not, because they're some got gloves, some don't. A lot of them don't have masks. According to him, even some of the COs are walking around uncovered. Andrew Cuomo, I ask you to let them go. I am in a prison's wife group, and I hear a lot of the cry of the women and the loved ones, but what can we do? Except for ask Andrew Cuomo, please let them go.
Formerly incarcerated community leader, and a mentor to many in New York City and beyond, the director of the Release Aging People in Prison campaign, Jose Saldana.
It's really saddening that Governor Cuomo states that he has no intentions of releasing anybody. If that is so, then his intent is to make New York State prisons death camps. Because this is the result of his intentions. He's bringing in 30,000-40,000 ventilators, thousands and thousands of ICU beds, transforming stadiums and parks into infield hospitals, all in a great effort to save lives of New Yorkers. But our question to him is, are the 45,000 human beings in New York State prisons, are the thousands of elderly with underlying health conditions facing health crises every day of their lives for years and decades, all other people with chronic health conditions, are their lives of equal value? Are they also human beings that you can dismiss and just sentence them to death? They weren't sentenced to death.
My name is Lavania Skaggs. My daughter's name is Dominic Skaggs. She's presently incarcerated at Albion Correctional Facility. We're from Long Island, where a lot of families are being impacted by this issue. She should not be incarcerated because having asthma like she does and taking breathing treatments, my daughter is vulnerable to catching and dying from the coronavirus, which would leave me taking care of her 5 children. She said, Mom, and I have a statement from her. She said, the main thing, Mom, is that I see nurses and I see these guards coming and going. They don't have PPE, Mom. And she said, I don't know if I'm being exposed. She said, they're up close and personal in our face. And she said, I don't know if I'm being exposed, Mom. She said, I'm afraid. She also said that when they asked, you know, what is going on? Give us some information. She said, literally, they're told nothing. My daughter, talking to her every day, she's going downhill. This is about our families. This is about our loved ones. Do something. This is your job. You want to be reelected? You do something about this. Do not doom these families to die. Send these people home.
Next up, we're going to hear from one of our legislative champions, somebody who has been supportive of this struggle and all related struggles for as long as she's been in office. I'm going to ask Assemblymember Carmen De La Rosa, representing parts of Upper Manhattan, to please say a few words.
I come to this fight from watching generations of men and women who I grew up with be locked up. People who have lost their loved ones to this system. And I agreed to carry, on behalf of the advocates, the elder parole bill here in New York State, because I believe that transformation is possible. I believe in a criminal justice system that transforms people and that gives them the opportunity to be productive members of our communities. We know that the clemency powers allow for people to be released right now. And we're calling on Governor Cuomo and his team that as they lead us through this crisis, to not forget the faces and the family members of those who are incarcerated right now. We're calling on Governor Cuomo to provide clemency for those people who have served the majority of their sentences, who have transformed their lives. The parole board also has a role in this, and that role needs to be not only in this time of crisis, but after the crisis. We need to make sure that we have a parole board that will interview people, that will grant people the ability to have parole. We also need to make sure that correction officers are being tested so that this disease isn't carried. We need to make sure that medical personnel who are coming into our prisons have the appropriate gear to treat and not transmit the disease to prisoners. We need to make sure that the living conditions in which these people are subjected to, if you're living in a dormitory setting, how can you quarantine? If you don't feel well, how can you quarantine? And so we need to make sure that we're advocating for these people and that they are released.
And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Central Park, a place where New Yorkers usually take a break from their busy lives, has been transformed by the erection of a hospital tent around the park's 97th Street transverse at Fifth Avenue. The field hospital is being built by Franklin Graham's evangelical Christian group, Samaritan's Purse, and will take in patients from the Mount Sinai Health System. The hospital in the park has 14 tents, 68 patient beds, and 10 ventilators, as well as x-ray equipment and a pharmacy. Meanwhile, crowds of gawkers ignored New York's social distance regulations and packed the west side of Manhattan on Monday to watch a U.S. Navy hospital ship arrive to give badly needed coronavirus aid. The U.S. Navy ship Comfort pulled into Pier 90 near West 50th Street at about 10:40 a.m. Reportedly, after members of the City Hall press corps tweeted about the throngs of people, Mayor Bill de Blasio's communications team directed the NYPD to get the crowds to disperse. De Blasio has said that New Yorkers who ignore orders from city officials could face $500 fines. And in Newark, New Jersey, police were called to a city housing project when someone complained about a group giving out free food.
Man, move back. Keep your distance.
You gotta get back.
Yo, y'all gotta get back.
Why? Why are you depriving people of free food? Why are you depriving people of free food?
That's right, the shock. What's going on, man?
Relax, man. We had to talk. What's going on?
We're
going
to feed the people this food. That's why we brought it here. Because this community has a right to eat.
Do me a favor.
Back up.
Okay, if you ain't got that permit, you can't do it. You ain't got the permit, you can't.
It's a human right to give people food. It's a human right. It's a First Amendment right.
Okay, we go with amendments. We're talking about quarantine.
I'm talking about amendments. It's talking about permits.
We're talking about safety.
Constitution supersedes permits.
It's talking about safety.
Constitution supersedes permits. And you're not going to give people free food. You guys going to have a riot on their hand.
We don't have a riot.
Yeah, okay.
We're 2,000 officers. We don't have no riot.
Yeah.
Back up, sir. Keep your distance like we're going to keep our distance.
The organization that gave out the food, the New African Black Panther Party, is led by its chairman, Shaka Zulu. He says his group was following social distancing and has no need for a permit when feeding the people.
We came like we normally do every week. We serve the people. We have a program called Empower the People, Empower the Block. And we have been serving the people almost a year now. And everywhere we go, we give out this free food. We give out literature. We bring the people into political life. And so today was no different. We went to Bradley Court because 2 days ago we was serving people on South Orange Avenue and 6th Street, and the police came up saying that they got a disorderly call. And we didn't buy into that because we are aware of the tactics of the pig. The pig was seeking to provoke us. But we let him know in no uncertain terms that we're going to assert our constitutional rights. And I guess he got on the phone with Ross Baraka, and 5 minutes later, they got up out of there. So today, we went to serve the people, empower the people. And it's a day that we think is a holy grail of Panther politics. You know, we want to feed the people. We want to empower the people. We want to bring them into political life. But the state is moving to curtail that. And they are specifically curtailing that because they don't want to see unity amongst poor people. They don't want to see unity in the black community. They don't want to see unity across the country where they begin to make their own masks. They begin to utilize their own small resources to buy masks for one another or to bring bags of food to one another. They don't want that because that threatens the system of capitalism. So when we came, we had a truck full of food, a truck full of food. And we were intent on passing that food out. Because we knew ahead of time that the pigs was going to come. But that didn't intimidate us. That didn't scare us. Your listeners know the Black Panther Party is not a coward organization. We don't bend and bow that easy. So we begin to unload the food off the truck because we have a human right to do that. I'm not talking about no constitutional right. I'm talking about the very fact that you are a human being. You have the right to assert your ability to survive as a human being by getting food. You don't need no law to tell you to eat. About 50 police arrived in all kinds of vehicles, different levels of the police force. And they sought to initially intimidate us. When he first came up, he said, put that food back on the truck. And I said to the pig, that food ain't going nowhere because we got a human right to get that food out to the people. The other one came and said the exact same thing. Do you have a permit? And I explained kindly, we don't do permits. The Black Panther Party think by the very fact that you being a human being, you have the right to walk anywhere you need to walk, to go where you want to go. No border, no flag, no law should impede human development. And so that's what we practice, and that's a fundamental law of revolutionary politics.
The officer, I heard the video, and he said it's a question of safety, that with this virus going around, that there should be no congregating of people. What do you say to that?
That was a good thing that he said. We said to him that we already have worked out a methodology of social distancing. And so if you look at the video, you can see comrades are probably 6 feet apart. 6 feet apart. And then the comrades that are coming, the people that are coming to get the food, they are also 6 feet apart. That's why the line is pretty long. So we worked that thing out. And then when the chief of the police came, I think he was the chief of police, he pulled me to the side. He said, what's going on? I said, we're feeding the people, and we are determined to feed the people. He said, okay, this is a good thing. So we're going to ask that y'all just maintain social distancing. And that's what we went back and did, maintain social distancing. The people came out. They began to clap and approve of what the Black Panther Party was doing. And so the police jumped in their car. But prior to that, comrade, there was all kinds of intimidation tactics. Just one short, brief story. She comes up and say, did you get anybody pre-approval before you came into the projects? This is a sister, a black sister, who looked like me. She could be my mother or my grandmother. I said, excuse me, we don't have to give anybody pre-approval because we're not a store. We're not into the commodity business. We're into serving the people. And she said, well, there's the police. I'm going to go over there and get them. Now, this is a sister, a black sister. I have to go on and get the police, get God. Matter of fact, get the whole ruling class, because we're not going anywhere.
Are you going to be going back out?
We will be going back out probably in about a week, 2 weeks time, because we just did this back-to-back. We did it 2 days ago. We're doing it again. So the comrades going to get some rest, do some studying, build our minds and bodies up. We'll be right back out there shortly.
Chairman Shaka Zulu of the Newark-based New African Black Panther Party. And as the United States heads into its greatest health crisis in a century, more and more people are questioning why a country billing itself as one of the world's highest standard of living still has so many without health insurance. A retired professor of epidemiology at the University of California in San Francisco is James Kahn. He says the worst case scenario is someone sick, turned away, who later dies.
A lot of times it's a judgment call. and someone's sick and obviously needs emergency care, and they have to ask the question, can this person make it to an emergency department, perhaps a public emergency department, or do we need to stabilize them here? As you might imagine, in a situation where that clinic is facing incurring quite a lot of expenditures, and someone thinks, well, I think this guy's okay to go to the emergency department, they'll send them off to the emergency department, and sometimes they're wrong. And as a result, you can get these very tragic situations.
How is that different from, let's say, the National Health Service in England?
Everyone's covered. And here, about 10% of people are not covered. And there's an additional problem that sometimes people go for care in an out-of-network provider, then they actually have insurance, but it's not the right kind of insurance. So it's a very different situation in the UK, and more generally in all the other wealthy countries. Everyone's covered through a publicly provided or publicly mandated plan.
And I can't understand politically why there's so much opposition, why so many Americans are said to be happy with their current health insurance.
That about 10% are completely uninsured. An additional very large percent, about 30%, are substantially underinsured. That means that they may have very high deductibles, sometimes several thousand dollars. These are costs that they need to pay before the insurance kicks in. So in effect, you're right. They are uninsured until they've spent those several thousand dollars. And as it happens, this pandemic is hitting us toward the beginning of the year. And so most people with deductibles haven't spent them down. And so de facto, they are uninsured. About two-thirds of the people who are insured get their insurance through job-based insurance. Now, the amount that employers are contributing is going down over time. So the employee has to pick up a larger portion, and those plans are shifting to the super high deductible plans.
How is that impacting this current crisis?
For those people who are uninsured or underinsured, or as we've discussed, de facto uninsured, they may not seek care. So that's a real problem. The other issue is that right now our data systems, our electronic health record, and the billing system that doctors use to get paid, they are chaotically complex. There are literally scores of different systems. And that means that they don't talk to each other. And anyone who's looking at the data that come in, say for billing purposes, can't make any sense of it. Under single payer or Medicare for all, you'd have a single electronic health record and a single portal to submit bills. So that data would be completely comprehensive, completely consistent, and this would help the public health authorities to understand where the epidemic is and how to react and when.
Why aren't Americans up in arms that they have such miserable insurance?
Health insurers and pharmaceutical companies stand to lose a lot of money if we switch to a publicly oriented Medicare for all system. The insurers would essentially go out of business with a very, very small residual role, and the drug companies would have to accept lower prices as in other countries. That's the political power dynamic. To advance this agenda, the insurers confuse matters. So they, for example, talk about the importance of choice, but they talk about it in the context of choosing your own health insurer. When what people really care about, if they think about it, is choice of doctor. But they conflate the issues. There's a wonderful op-ed in the New York Times in January by my colleague Wendell Potter, former insurance company executive, who kind of reveals this tactic of the insurers to confuse people about what kind of choice they really want. And so when people hear, oh, I'm going to lose a choice of my insurance company, they get scared without really thinking about it, and they are less supportive of Medicare for All than if they realized this would guarantee choice of doctor.
We're in the middle of like the biggest health crisis in a century, maybe the biggest in the history of the world right now. What's going to happen in America? Are we going to come out of this, you know, with a de facto national health service? Because that's what we need.
This is a fight for social change. Social change is one of those things that you never think is going to happen, and then you keep fighting for it, and the right pieces fall into place. So we saw this in the civil rights. We saw this with gay marriage. And this is another chance where we just need to keep fighting for what to many of us seems like the obvious right thing to do, a solution which is opposed by vested interests. So we need to keep demonstrating that the vested interest should not preempt welfare of the public.
James G. Kahn is a retired professor of epidemiology at the University of California in San Francisco. And that's some of the news for Monday, March 30th, 2020. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiPienzo.